I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. The author and historian Alan Levine joins me now. His latest book, published last fall, was a comprehensive, accessible, and highly readable King, William Lyon Mackenzie King, A Life Guided by the Hand of Destiny. It's the first major biography on King in more than 30 years, and it brings to life this complicated, accomplished, fascinating man. King was born in 1874 and died 75 years later in 1950. He was a lawyer, civil servant, and politician who went on to become Canada's 10th Prime Minister, serving a total 22 years, first defeating Arthur Meighen in 1921 and replacing Meighen again following the King-Byng affair. He loses to R.B. Bennett in 1930 and replaces Bennett 5 years later, serving until 1948. It's impossible in the few minutes we have with Mr. Levine to go over King's life, but he does such a fine job in just over 500 pages telling us about King in this book. We'll ask him how he got to writing it, what's in the book, and more. Alan Levine has written 11 books, including the award-winning Coming of Age and one of my favorites, Scrum Wars. His website is at alanlevinebooks.com. He joins me from Winnipeg this day, where he teaches history. The book is published by Douglas and McIntyre. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Alan Levine. Mr. Levine, good morning.
Morning.
Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
So you emailed me a few weeks ago.
Right.
I guess you'd read that I was reading the book over the holidays.
Right. Well, like all authors, I tend sometimes to scour the web for any and all comments about my book.
Right.
I'm ashamed to say. So I did. Yes, I do know his blogs. I suppose it's a new thing. I can't remember the last. I mean, even with my last book, maybe the last one, but for the last 5 years, yes, there's lots of web traffic and comments and other kinds of writings about one's books that is a lot different from it used to be.
Yeah. Now I got the book, I guess, in the fall when the
right.
book came out. Your publisher sent the book.
Yeah.
There was just a ton of books that came out that season.
Yes, it's true.
And so this is why we've only gotten to talk to each other now.
Right.
One of the to talk about the book and its reception. One of the columnists had said about the number of books that had come out. You know, the book on MacDonald, your book,
yeah.
Turner, Darcy right. McGee, that they wouldn't be widely read. Despite the number of books and sort of the need for these sorts of books about our past. Do you
right.
find that with this book that there was a need that you were trying to fill about King?
I think so. I don't agree with that, actually. And in fact, I told the columnist you were talking about is Lawrence Martin of the Globe, who
yeah.
actually came to a book reading I did in Ottawa, and I actually brought that up. It was maybe a few days after he'd written the column, and there were people there, so I told him that. In fact, he was wrong. People were interested. I believe that, I mean, listen, it's hard selling books nowadays anyways, but I do believe that there is an interest in nonfiction history written in a way that people can read it, and people are fascinated by other people's lives. That's why I think biography still, in fact, if you talk to bookstores, biography is still a big seller, although there are many biographies all the time coming out. But King is such a bizarre person, a successfully bizarre person, and such a weird one, that I don't think people can't be helped drawn to his story if it's told in the right way. I mean, that was the problem with a lot of the academic books. I mean, there's lots of academic stuff on King. In fact, I used much of it, and many of the old biographies. The trouble is they get sort of bogged down in the kind of academic day-to-day detail of running the country that people really aren't interested in. And so I decided that there was room for a real biography of him that not only he incorporated his private life, his bizarre private life, in a way that made sense, and as well as looked at some of the major issues that he was involved in from a different perspective. And American historians are always bringing out new books. I mean, look at McCullough's books on John Adams. And those are fantastic books, very popular, and I don't see, I thought it was time to do the same thing. And as you said, you know, Richard Gwynne has great success with the MacDonald books, too, because he looks at it in a fresh way.
This is, as I mentioned in the intro, the first book in 30 years. Was the last book? That was Colonel Stacy's book, right?
Yeah, I was thinking more like the major, the the three-volume biography of King that had been officially sanctioned, started by Dawson, McGregor Dawson in the 1950s, and Blair Neepy finished in 1976. It's probably even more than 30 years, yeah. And then Stacy's book was the first book, but that was really like Stacy's take on the diary, because he was one of the first people to actually get access to it. So he wrote this. It really wasn't about King's public life. He just wrote about what he found in the diary, all the crazy things. And that was in 1976, too. So, you know, since then, I mean, there's a plethora of theses and articles about King, but no one had ever attempted to actually write a book about him. You know, I initially thought it deserves a two-volume biography, but my publisher talked me out of that, and I'm glad they did. I think in capturing him in one book was probably a better idea. But there had been, I mean, part of the issue with King and other books about him was that his private life was always sort of pushed in the background. There seems to have been, Stacy had attempted to sort of introduce this concept of King's double life, sort of like a Jekyll and Hyde story, and historians sort of latched onto that, and they always attempted to sort of say that all this craziness of spiritualism and all the other crazy interpretations of his dreams and his other paranoid ideas were not really important to how he ran the country. And I decided that it's impossible to separate him, that he is who he was, and that his all this stuff imprinted on him in a thousand different ways that it's impossible to unravel. But to dismiss that seems to me to be a rather incorrect way of looking at him. I mean, he's just a very complicated man, and certainly somewhat strange. And from a biographer's point of view, it's so rare that someone has access to the day-to-day feelings of your subject over, like, what, 50 years or more. I mean, it was that diary is unbelievable and fantastic, really. So as a resource, I couldn't have asked for anything better. I mean, and even if some of the stuff was distorted and which I've discovered, or King has a various versions of reality, it's still what he was thinking at any day of the week, at any time, and so you really get a great, amazing sense of who he was.
Now, you talked about approaching King from a different perspective, and one of the perspectives is time. Is there stuff in this book that you write about that couldn't have been written about, say, in even Colonel Stacy's time or Pickard?
Yes, well, there's certainly, Stacy broached his relationship with all these various women and his relationship with Joan Patterson, his best friend, this married woman in Ottawa. So I delved, I think, a little bit more into that. I also tracked down her granddaughters, which was a great piece of detective work, I have to say. And it turns out that John McCallum, the Liberal MP, is this woman's great-grandson.
Uh-huh.
So I through him, I tracked down his mother, and she talked to me about what it was like to be a little girl, and she knew Mackenzie King, so that was really interesting. But that was one. And the other, I mean, another area, for example, is King's, in the book I deal with the Japanese issue during World War II, the Jewish refugee issue in the 1930s. None of his biographers dealt with that. No one wrote about it, no one knew about it. I mean, since the 70s, there have been lots of books, none is too many, by Irving Abel and Harold Troper about the refugee issue, for example, and lots of books about the Japanese treatment of Japanese during World War II. So those were things that had not really been looked at in a comprehensive fashion, how King had dealt with him and what really went on in the cabinet room. And I even approached it differently from a lot of the other people, in that I, you know, dealt exclusively on what was going on in King's head, and I used a diary to track that. And it was very interesting. If you read the diary, you cringe sometimes at his racism, at least from our perspective. I mean, mm-hmm. I try not to. I make it a point to judge people from the time period that they lived, and, you know, things like anti-Semitism were fairly common in Canada during 1920s to 1960s, in fact. So King was really, he wasn't virulent in any way, he wasn't a fascist, but he was a product of his time, nevertheless.
So about the bigotry, about what he thought, in terms of how, I would say normal, but how acceptable it was. I mean, in terms of the times, was it?
Oh, sure. I mean, anti-Semitism was part of the Canadian culture. I mean, people have this. Today, we always think of multiculturalism. It's been around forever. Canada was just really a. You know, people coming here, the Anglo-conformity was very high. Restrictions, for example, on clubs, social activities, beaches, property areas were common across Canada. So that was just the way it was. I mean, there's a great story. I found that because the diary is, thank God, frankly, I wouldn't have done the book at the archives, the Library and Archives Canada, not digitized it. Years ago, using the diary years ago, when I did Scrumwars, for example, which you mentioned,
right. The
diary was on microfiche, and you couldn't search it, and you had to know which day you were looking for. You couldn't find subjects, and it's 30,000 pages. And even though it was transcribed, it was like pictures, like microfiche of typed material, so researching it was impossible. I don't actually know how anybody spent, you'd have to spend years.
Yeah.
But about 10 years ago, they digitized it, so you can access it through the web. And not only the best thing is you can search it. Mm-hmm. So you can find days you're looking for, and you can search words. Now, it's not always best, but, if you type in things like Jews, you get all these excerpts that probably no one had ever read before because it was impossible to find. And, just really very kind of, I thought they were funny, but, King runs out to his Kingsmere estate in 1929 because he hears this rumor that some Jews are about to buy some adjacent property, so he runs out there and makes a down payment on it and buys it so that these people won't get access to it. I mean, stuff like that. Or I found, this unbelievable reference in 1945 when the Americans dropped a bomb on Hiroshima. King writes, this is in his diary that day, it's terrible destruction. He hates war, but on the other hand, if they had to drop it on someone, so it's okay that they dropped it on the Japanese rather than white people in Europe. I mean, and he says this, and I'm sure he wasn't the only one who thought so.
Yeah.
Jack Pickersgill in his memoirs, who I had met, in fact, when I interviewed Scrum Wars in the 90s, he doesn't think they did anything wrong in the way they treated Japanese people. He just didn't see it. So it was just part of the culture. And King has said some pretty drastic things about black people and throughout, and you would think that you were reading something from, southern United States.
Yeah.
But I honestly think it was current and common, and that's how people thought. And, with the Jewish refugees in the 30s, he knew that, in fact, he did know that he had a conscience about it. His Christian conscience was bothering him, and he knew that he should let more Jewish refugees in, but the cabinet, and particularly the Quebec contingent led by Ernest Lapointe, where anti-Semitism was pretty bad in Quebec, and there's just resistance all around, and Quebec was really valuable to the Liberal Party. King won a lot of seats there, and he just let Lapointe have his day, even though he wrote in his diary how history will judge us wrongly about this, so I thought that was interesting. But that was the way things were.
Yeah,
and that I think those kinds of issues no one had ever dealt with in a way in that way before about him, and bringing it into exactly what was going on. So I think the book does break some new ground there.
Did you have to read the whole diary for this?
Well, I didn't. I say that in the book. I don't think it's possible. Although I have been told by an older veteran historian, Professor Peter Waite, that he's read good chunks of it. I did read a lot, and I honestly—it's impossible, though. I mean, it would take a person forever.
Yeah.
I did, I delved into it extensively in spots and around issues that I was looking for, but I didn't read it from start to finish. I did read an awful lot, though.
Yeah, as a document
over the period of time. I can't say that I read every single entry. You have to, when you start, he must have spent an inordinate amount of time. I couldn't figure, he did dictate it later in his life to his secretary, but until the 30s, like that was only after 35, say, and until the 1930s, he used to write it out, and so he must have spent an awful lot of time.
During the day.
Some of the entries aren't all that long, but then you get, these pages upon pages, and this is the typed version I saw. When he died, one of the executors of the will, one of it who had been a secretary, his name was Fred McGregor, he actually read the entire written portion of the diary into a dictaphone, and then his army of typists in Ottawa typed it out. I mean, it took something like 3 years. Now, you know, as I said, I put that make a point of that. If that hadn't been done, no one ever would have been able to use it in the same way, because his handwriting was really hard to read. And they had done it at that point because the first Dawson, McGregor Dawson, who was writing the official biography, the first volume, wanted to use it, and so that's how the diary ended up being transcribed. But that must have been an enormous task. I mean, this guy McGregor just could read the writing, but I can't even imagine having to use the handwritten version. So he spent, but King must have spent just an enormous amount of time doing this. And he had a busy life, even though he wasn't married, he had no children, but he certainly lived and breathed as a prime minister 15 hours a day, every day.
Now, how reliable a document is it? You mentioned earlier that it was he had sort of a distorted view of reality.
Right.
When he was writing about himself, was he fair?
I mean, most of the things are. It's not so much. I mean, people have pointed out to me, I caught a few versions of reality that he distorts, or his accounting of events, like all of us do. You know, we see things through our own eyes, aren't completely accurate. But I mean, generally, I think when you compare his version of what went around the cabinet table with the diaries of, let's say, some of the other cabinet ministers kept records also, they more or less match. So, you know, the diary is more interesting because you get to see what he's thinking about everybody, and he could be very nasty, and he was very sensitive to any comment negative about him. I mean, he remembered, he had a very long memory and remembered every insult that someone ever made to him, and he blew things way out of proportion, and someone looked at him the wrong way, and so this became an issue. Whether or not, in fact, I mean, it's hard. It was obviously hard. I couldn't tell whether or not some of these things were true or not. At least the way he remembered them, because it was impossible to check. Some of these are private meetings, and this is King's version. So I tried to keep that in mind, obviously. But some of the things, I think that it's a fairly, you know, as far as diaries go, which are always obviously subjective. It's a pretty fair document to judge things by, but you have to take some of it with a grain of salt, of course.
So in terms of King's faith, his spirituality or his spiritualism, was he religious at all? How did that evolve?
Very religious man. He went to church all the time, good Presbyterian. I make the point, spiritualism, even though, the fact is he wasn't the only spiritualist, that during the time of the First World War in particular, when so many young men were died, many people in Britain and around and in Canada were fascinated by spiritualism and attempted to figure out the meaning of life or what happened after death. The King lost 5 members of his family around that period of time in a short, 5 years or so, and he was lonely, and I think he found some solace in spiritualism, and there was a whole network of famous people in Canada and who were interested in this kind of thing. So to him, it was, I think, an extension of his religious faith. I mean, I call the subtitle of the book is "Guided by the Hand of Destiny." That's a phrase from King's diary, because he believed from till the day he died that his life was in fact guided by God or some hand or unseen hand and so forth.
Now, how much of whatever he, I guess, heard, you talk in the book about the seances and the, I guess, they called it table wrapping then.
That's definitely bizarre.
Yeah.
With messages, I mean, God knows how certain knocks and, it sounds like someone playing a Ouija board.
Yeah.
And they actually took this seriously, and it is bizarre. Now, listen, the whole thing is crazy, and he attended seances and...
Did that affect his decision-making politically?
Did it? There are times I found that it did. I mean, when to call an election, what would happen. I don't know. Again, this is the issue. It's hard to say exactly. He doesn't write down, he does a few times say, so his Mrs. Bellini, his seance person from Kingston, had told him to call the election in 1930 that he lost to Bennett, set this certain date, and he does, and things don't work out, but he rationalizes them away because he has so much faith in her. And that happens a lot, actually. When he gets a false prediction, he just rationalizes it as evil spirits or something invading it. I mean, he's very good at all that kind of stuff because he wants to believe and he needs to believe, so he keeps on. Does it actually affect his decision as a prime minister? It's harder to pin down. Other than that one time, there's maybe a few other specific examples. See, but it's my point that it does imprint on him, and he is, who knows exactly what he's, you know, you don't know exactly what he's doing, but he's not listening. I mean, there are times when he doesn't consult his seance people on, you know, should he pass a bill or something like that, obviously. It does, you know, he spends certainly an awful lot of time doing it, so it's hard to say that it didn't affect him. They obviously didn't affect monetary policy or economic decisions. I guess he does somewhat can separate a bit out of that. Obviously, he's a smart man, and he's not crazy. You know, like I don't think he's actually crazy, though it sounds like it sometimes in the book.
Yeah.
But I don't really believe that he was. I just think he was troubled and sort of very complicated.
And what have you concluded about his sexuality?
Good question. Well, yes, I know. I wrote in the book, Jack Granenstein, who is a well-known King historian and expert, suggested to me that King may never have had sex in his life. I mean, I can't honestly find proof that he did or did not. My impression is that he might have once or twice. I mean, he didn't have it very often, and he was very, from our perspective, if you read some of his stuff and he went to see an early version of a psychiatrist in 1916, and those records are available. And you would think that he was very simplistic. He had no understanding of his own body and his own sexuality. Now, that may have been more common for men growing up in sort of more puritanical period than we live in now. But he didn't really understand what was going on. I don't know. I mean, it's hard to say. Like, you know, as I said, his closest relationship was with a married woman, Joan Pattison. Stacy suggests, and there's one sort of possibility of something happening between them very early in their relationship in the early 1921 or so. But again, the story of that has been actually cut out of the diary by King, so no one really knows what happened in those few days of possibilities. But he also had a relationship with a woman who was about 10 years older than him when he was younger. She was the wife of a minister, actually, in Ottawa. And they had some pretty intense love letters between them. So no one, again, you know, other people who've looked at them suggest we don't really know, but if you read the pet names they have for them and the way in which they wrote each other, certainly the woman writing to King, you certainly get the impression it was pretty intimate. So I don't know about that, but you know, that was another person who he might have. And he had a few girlfriends, and he had many. I mean, he spent, 25 years of his life or more searching for a wife. He was close a few times.
He was looking for someone that was like his mother, I guess, right?
Well, that's the thing about King, right? He put his mother on a pedestal, and even more so after she died, and no woman could come close to her. But again, I think that's frankly, he's a bit selfish, and I'm not so sure. He said he wanted to share his life. I'm not so sure he did. He got pretty set in his way, so that may have just been a convenient excuse. But yeah, clearly his idea and relationship about his mother and kissing her picture various times and her bust of her, and it's pretty weird and by any standard, I would admit. And if you go to Laurier House today in Ottawa where he lived, you know, this famous painting highlighted by light, it's still there in his office. And you can see how big it was, and it sat beside his desk, and it's fairly strange.
We haven't touched on King and his achievement as prime minister. In your contention, is he the greatest prime minister we've ever had?
I don't know the greatest. That's a I am not sure if I would say that, but he's certainly one of them. I mean, he's in the top three, I would think. You know, with certainly up there with Johnny McDonald, mainly because, you know, longevity certainly has to count. I mean, anybody who's prime minister for as many years as 22 and a half years, I don't think Harper's going to come that close, but, I mean, he obviously transformed the country, good or bad, or however, whatever he did, he was there, so you can't just dismiss him. I mean, it's one of the longest reigning rulers in a democratic country probably ever, so, I mean, he clearly had an impact on Canadian history. So in that sense, I think he was one of the most important prime ministers. Great may not be. It's hard to think of him as being great, I suppose. But he, you know, he reshaped Canadian relations with Britain and the United States for the better. I mean, he sort of was instrumental in pushing Canada towards sort of this Commonwealth status, and he did so in a positive way. He opened up, better trade relations and so forth with the U.S. He kept the country together during World War II. He understood Quebec, or at least he, again, you know, this is, he was, it was opportunistic for him, but, certainly understood that keeping Quebec happy was an important part to Canadian unity, and he did, his whole career he spent doing that. He's sort of seen as the godfather of the welfare state in Canada, and it took him a long, long time. I mean, he did share in those ideas early as a young man and wrote about it when he worked for the Rockefellers during World War One, and those ideas, I mean, he was sort of like a social democrat. He had some of those ideas that you would find, let's say, in the British Labour Party. But it took him a long, long time to actually do anything into the 1940s, and maybe Canada wasn't ready yet either. But listen, I think, you know, he deserves a certain amount of credit for understanding the importance of things like unemployment insurance and old age pensions and other issues that we have today. So, you know, I think he could give him some credit for pushing that agenda as well. So I think in that sense, And he brilliantly managed Canada during World War II, there's no doubt. I mean, even though he was junior to Churchill and Roosevelt, at least he was at the table, whether or not they... I mean, they didn't necessarily... They treated him respectfully, but I'm not sure exactly. He didn't exactly play the same kind of role, obviously, in winning the war.
And in terms of his skill as a politician, what can the politicians of today, what can they learn from
him? Well, I mean, he understood that he understood that extremism does not work in Canadian politics. And, I mean, I think, frankly, Harper has learned that, too, although he seems to be slipping, if you ask me. But you have to hug that middle-of-the-road in Canada to be successful, and King did that better than anybody else of his generation. He had the benefit that the Conservatives under Arthur Meehan and Bennett, were certainly under Meehan in the 20s, just did not get that. So they, you know, Meehan alienated Quebec, he alienated labor in Western Canada and across the country, he alienated Western farmers with a tariff, and you know, King just decided that he would adopt policies just to appease enough people, and that he would continue to win elections. And so he understood more than anybody that if you don't win elections, there's really no point to being in politics. And so the Conservatives stuck to their principles, and King kept winning elections. So he certainly benefited from that. He lived in a time when Quebec nationalism did not produce a party like the Bloc Québécois, or an other alternative. So it was between really him and the Conservatives, and Quebec was never going to vote for the party who had supported conscription in World War One, and going back to even hang Louis Riel in 1885. I mean, those kinds of things they had long memories about, and Quebec Conservatives suffered for years over issues like that, and King and the Liberals benefited. I mean, to me, that's the one thing since Trudeau, or I guess since Chrétien, I mean, the Liberals have lost Quebec to that. Since 1993, they've lost Quebec, and that was one of the areas where they could always count on a lot of seats. I mean, King was winning amazing. Quebec had 65 seats during King's years. Mm-hmm. He won almost every single election. He was winning 59 to 65 of those seats. Even in 1930, when he lost, he won 40 of 65. So So, I mean, that's a huge advantage when you can be guaranteed one province's votes like that and seats, and there was a lot of them. So it ended up, you know, the fight came down to Ontario, and he was always winning enough. The Conservatives would win a chunk of Ontario, but King won enough that he stayed in power. And he did it time and again, even when he had a minority government situation once or twice. He still was successful, and it was those Quebec seats that made the difference. So he certainly handled that well. I mean, he was an opportunist to a certain extent, probably. But on the other hand, he remained in power and did so at the expense of his rivals.
Alan, it's been nice to talk today. Congratulations on a very fine achievement. It's a really great book.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. The book is called King, William Lyon Mackenzie King, A Life Guided by the Hand of Destiny. It's published by Douglas & McIntyre. Mr. Levine's website is at alanlevinebooks.com. Alan Levine on the line from Winnipeg in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunder.